And I seem to get variable results depending on environment too, right? Like here, my waveforms are fairly small. There's not, I'm normally used to seeing significantly more spike to them. But
oh, yeah, they're not really tall, are they?
But then equally, the noise floor is very low. So like once I normalize and do all the other stuff, it'll actually turn out probably really, really well. But
great.
For our purposes. Well, welcome back to another episode of Scouting Stuff You Should Know. This, you know what? I'm not even going to try for an episode number. I get them wrong every time. So, we are rejoined by Regan Coyne, who is the area support manager. Gosh, I got to get these titles right. The ASM for Scouts Canada's Northern Lights Council. It's nice to have you back, Regan. Hi.
Thanks. I love to come back and be part of Scouting Stuff You Should Know.
And this week, I thought we would talk about, well, we've had a few different topics that we've kind of been percolating for a while, but one that's kind of come up again and again is this whole scouting myths thing. And I know that on, it's kind of fun, you were pointing out just before we started recording, it's kind of funny that the Scouts Canada wiki, wiki.scouts.ca, for those of you who have not yet stumbled over it, actually does have a whole page devoted to scouting myths, a list of debunked myths, urban legends, and common misconceptions. And it actually does a pretty good job of trying to, you know, point to references, whether that's bylaw policy and procedures or, you know, sort of official commentary from people in the organization. But you were pointing out that it's interesting that, you know, the wiki even maintains one, that there's actually a whole wiki page devoted to this.
Well, I was even surprised in our last podcast that I joined. I didn't realize this was a legit thing. I thought this was something that was just happening on its own, but it's actually maintained by Scouts Canada, isn't it?
Well, the wiki is, yeah, for the most part. I mean, I don't know if it's like, you know, one of the paid staff or if it's a volunteer position behind it. Maybe it says somewhere on the wiki here. But yeah, I mean, it's the wiki itself is hosted through scouts.ca, which is the official website. So, you know, broadly speaking, I mean, I would tend to treat it as an official reference, or at least, you know, like this document, like I said, where possible, it tries to refer out to things like BPNP, you know, tries to refer to documentation where it can. So, you know, if the wiki itself is not quote unquote official, then at least as much as possible, it tries to point out to official sources to you know, clarify what it's offering. But yeah, I mean, generally, I do try and treat the wiki as one of the official sources that's available to us. It's there's sometimes a bit of a challenge with the wiki because, you know, like it won't necessarily get updated when something will get updated on scouts.ca or scoutinglife.ca, which of course has now also become a fairly big source of information. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's still a good resource to use. And I mean, the scouting myths that we're going to be talking about today, certainly some of them I was not aware of. One of the first ones that I wanted to look into, for example, was knives. Because, like, the way we've been doing it, and this is not something unique to how we've been doing Cubs. It's kind of something that we've been, doing within our group. And so I have to phrase this carefully because I don't want to, you know, sound like I'm really going against the group or criticizing the group's decisions in this regard. But the understanding I had was that, you know, basically our Cub Scouts weren't allowed to use knives at all. And in fact, there have been a couple of cases where I've had youth who are now Cubs who've come through the Beaver program that I've been running. And one of the things we do with the Beavers is we make like basic survival kit type things, right? Waterproof bags, some water purification tablets, there's things to keep warm with, stuff like that, right? You know, some basic, really thin little kit they can throw it in a bag when they go hiking. And it's, you know, just, it's a nice exposure to some of the concepts of, well, like, you know, in the outdoor adventure skills, the scout craft and the outdoor survival, that kind of, you know, just good knowledge for them to have. But catered to the beaver level, i.e. lots of physical, tangible things. Mm-hmm. And obviously we don't give the beavers knives. Beavers aren't allowed to use knives. I think that much is certain. Mm-hmm. Well, but even then, I suppose not. We'll find out. I may have just committed another myth there. But some of the beaver scouts, of course, that we've worked with on these have moved up to cubs. And a couple of them at different events have brought out their little survival kits. You know, they bring them along quite dutifully, and that's nice to see. But then they've put like a little pocket knife or a Swiss Army knife or something into the kit. And to date, we've been discouraging that, you know, or saying, you know, okay, I mean, you can keep it in for your own use, but at a scouting event, I need you to leave it at home. But apparently, that isn't quite the case.
Yeah, it's not quite the case. Parts of it are there, but not fully the case. And this one's been popping up a lot with the Canadian Path. The youth want to use knives. So scouters are asking, like, so can cubs and beavers use knives? We want to practice and teach knife skills. So I always point them to BPAMP, and specifically section 13,021, tools and knives. And it says, knives, safety folding blade type, including multipurpose tools, may be used during age-appropriate activities by all members, excluding beavers, providing it is a bona fide requirement of the particular activity. So as long as you need a knife for what you're doing, everyone except for beavers can use knives.
Right. Okay?
The thing that comes about is then, what about the knife permit? Are we making this too exciting too early? And does it take away the merits of the knife permit? And the knife permit is part of this, but the knife permit is so that a youth can carry a knife on their person, that they've learned to be responsible for their knife. Okay? And just carry it whenever they want. However, cubs can't get their knife permit. Because that's a scouting activity. It's a scouting challenge, right? So then it comes back to providing it's for a bona fide requirement of the particular activity. So cubs can use knives for the activity. Now, what about beavers? So it says that beavers are excluded from this, that they can't use knives, but they can use knives in age-appropriate ways. An age-appropriate knife skill for a beaver might be buttering their toast. They might not even get to do that at home with a butter knife. So that Fair would enough. Be a knife skill that they might need to learn. Useful life skill, saves you time at camp. You're not buttering their toast for them.
I forget that people put butter on toast. My kids just prefer dry toast for whatever reason. It baffles me, but there you go. But yeah, no, that's a good point because, well, I mean, yeah. It's funny too how kids even think about that, right? Because like, I mean, I've got a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old. And like the 8-year-old's fine. Like she'll use not a steak knife, but she'll use a butter knife with her dinner to, you know, cut and manipulate stuff on her plate, and that's fine. But the 6-year-old is still very hesitant around them, even though it's just a butter knife. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've shown them repeatedly, look, I can run it along my thumb and nothing is happening. And the 3-year-old is just like, oh, boo-boo knife. Won't touch it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, she'll like see the knife on the counter and she knows that it's a knife and therefore, you know, in her mind is associated with a danger. And this is true for whether it's a butter knife or a steak knife, but then of course she'll like pick it up and hold it out for you. Right. Mm. It's like, okay, well thank you. I'm glad you realize the knife is dangerous, but, maybe don't just thrust it right out at me like that.
Yeah. And appropriate knife skills for beavers yeah. can even include like how to safely pass a knife to somebody using a butter knife, of course.
Yes, of course.
Using an age appropriate knife. Like knives are a very general topic. We definitely wouldn't be giving a 6-inch blade with a serrated edge to a beaver to practice buttering toast.
No.
Or some sort of
I mean, unless we wanted the activity. Beaver to have lots of cuts and the toast to not be toast anymore.
Yes. We wanted crumbs.
Yes. Yeah. But that is a good point, right? Is that, I mean, yeah, knife being the very broad category that it is, there's, you know, obvious. But it equally, too, like, even just looking at how BPNP is written, it really seems to focus more on, you know, I guess, and I guess too, like when we think about, you know, okay, like this is a knife in a scouting context, we're not generally thinking about a butter knife, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like that could be part of their mess kit. Actually, I would hope that a good mess kit would include, you know, even just a plastic butter knife. Mm-hmm. But usually I think, and certainly like the way BP&P is worded, right? It's like knives, safety, knives, bracket, safety folding blade type, including multi-purpose tools, may be used during age-appropriate program activities by all members, excluding beavers. And to my mind, that sort of, you know, seems to suggest that it's making a bit of a differentiation between, yeah, you know, a duller instrument like a butter knife. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this case, it's talking more about the sharpened, not just for buttering your toast kind of blades.
It's definitely making that distinction pretty clear that it's talking about a real knife that you could use to like cut wood with or do any purpose of things at camp, right?
Pretty much. And so, okay, let's come back to the example of my cubs, right? Because we were talking about the cubs with their little survival kits, mm-hmm. and they've now incorporated a pocket knife into that mix. So how do we proceed on that one, right? Like, I mean, do we allow it? Do we say, well, you know, like, I mean, no, you still can't be carrying that around with you, I guess would be actually the read there, right? Is like, you know, because they would still need the knife permit to actually carry the blade around at a scouting activity. Mm-hmm. So probably wouldn't necessarily be able to have them include it in their kit.
So one thing that I've had come up with youth is that I've had scouters who've been talking to their youth and they've come up and said, I cut my hand at camp. And you're like, oh, what did you cut your knife on? And they say, oh, well, I had a knife in my pack and I was looking for my socks and my hand slipped and I grabbed my knife by accident. And that would be a case of not storing your knife properly or keeping it in a safe space, right? And that's what the knife permit educates about. So I would be cautious to say cubs should have knives with them, right? Like BP&P says that they should have even the safety folding blade just for the activity they need it for. So carrying it around at a scouting activity in their survival kit, I think, would be a push. You could say, yeah, you can have your knife for this activity, but we'll keep them for the rest while we're out on survival.
Yeah, or leave it in your tent or something like that, right?
Maybe. I wouldn't even leave it in their tent. Just, what if another youth grabs it?
That's true, right? Too, right? Yeah, I guess you have to keep in mind that, yeah, people could go through other people's stuff, as much as you hope that wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that's true, too. And yeah, I guess that's another good point to differentiate as well, and BP&P does this as well, is that, you know, it kind of differentiates between knives with the folding blade and then knives with a fixed blade.
Hmm.
Which, and I mean, again, like the knife permit kind of just broadly applies to all of these and covers, you know, how to properly care for and store and use them. But yeah, I mean, there is definitely a difference between, you know, like a cub having a small folding blade, folding and locking blade. Mm-hmm. And I think the lock is probably another, important aspect of that, although I don't see it, at least in the quote from BP&P right here.
Yeah, when I took my wood badge too, so maybe I'm attributing to another scouting myth here, but I was told locking blade. It has to be a locking blade or a sheath blade. Have you heard that before, or is that just a myth that I've picked up now?
That's a good question. I mean, let's click on, like, I mean, if I pull up the sort of the broader BP&P, right, is that... So actually in BP&P, yeah, it goes a little further. Well, actually, and it's quoted here too. Yeah. So sheathed knives can only be worn when it's a bona fide requirement of the scouting activity and only by scouts, venturers, rovers, and scouters. So it would seem that within BP&P, we are making a bit of a distinction that we are treating, you know, a sheathed knife, which is generally a fixed blade, mm-hmm. you know, as being a separate category than the folding blade types. And I mean, when I was looking around, I didn't find anything, you know, differentiating between, you know, like it must be a locking blade or not a locking blade. Even the knife permit documents that I found that have been produced by various scout groups capture both types.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, certainly you can find, like most Swiss Army knives, you know, even probably out there in the scout shop, don't necessarily have blade locks on them, right? So I think that would probably fall under the banner of myth, because certainly I've not in my research found any documentation to support it. But then equally, it's one of those things where, while it might not be a requirement, it's also not a bad idea. You know, if you have a locking, if the blade folds out, the blade can fold back in just as easily, unless there's a lock to hold it in place. And at least for introducing youth to knives, it's probably better if you have the additional safety features to start with. And then, you know, you can, once they're comfortable just, you know, using knife as knife at a basic level, then you can start introducing, you know, it's like, okay, well, and in this case, you know, okay, so here you see the blade snaps into position, and then you actually have to push this thing here to get it back. Okay. Now this knife, notice how it's different. It just folds open, folds closed. What does that mean? It means you have to be more careful.
Definitely.
So, you know, I could see how there would be a really obvious progression in terms of how you would teach safety for each type of knife there. But yeah, as far as I can tell, there's nothing in the requirements, policy, procedures, or even in the knife training, the knife permit requirements that have been put together that, you know, suggest, no, it has to be a locking blade. So,
and then, like, one activity that I just thought of, that if your youth are really into learning about knives and they want to learn how to whittle, you could even use a popsicle stick to whittle something like soap and give them a taste of what they can do later with a real knife.
That's very true.
On your parents' comfort level with you showing them a skill that they can then take home and use with a real knife. Adult supervision is a good thing.
Actually, if anything, they might... I'm just trying to think about, you know, using a popsicle stick on a bar of soap. I think if anything, they'd probably learn... Oh, I don't know. Would this be a good thing or a bad thing? I got to wonder, because, I mean, a popsicle stick is not a particularly precision thing. You know, certainly not nearly as honed down as even a butter knife blade would be. And soap can be a little slippery. So they'd either, like, learn much more control than they would need if it was an actual knife with a piece of wood, but then maybe they would also learn to overcompensate. I don't know. More research required.
I might have to try this one myself.
Yeah, I think so. I have spare bars of soap. We just went to Costco. It's all good. Related to this, there's sort of a second myth surrounding knives. Anyways, sorry, before we kind of move on, I guess, just loop back. Is that, so yeah, Cub Scouts can be allowed to use knives, but they can't get their knife permits. And, you know, consequently, they can't carry the knives at activities. So we've kind of been doing it right, but equally we can, you know, allow them limited use of blades in the future. And that might be a useful thing. And I guess my approach going forward, it could just be that, okay, look, if you have a knife with you for the duration of this event, I need to hold on to it. But if we need to use it at any point, I will give it back to you. That could work.
I think that would work well. And I think youth would be accepting of that too.
Maybe I'll have to work in a whittling activity or something. All right. So anyways, related to this is sort of a second myth about knives, and that is blade length. Scouts cannot have, carry, or use knives with a blade larger than 7 centimeters. It's not the...
Math isn't my strong suit.
That's about, what is that here? Got to think here. Yeah, conversion.
Like the length of an iPhone?
Yeah. Does that work out to about, 4.3 inches, something like that. It's not the longest blade in the world, by any means.
That doesn't sound very useful. Like, if you're splitting wood, you want a longer blade than that.
True, yeah. Well,
Anyway, back to the myth.
Yeah, back to the myth. All practical considerations of a short blade aside. Apparently, there's nothing in BP&P about this.
Nothing.
Well, we already talked about, like, you know, you already mentioned 13021.
We read you the whole section, so yes. It's not in there.
No.
But the wiki is really interesting. So the wiki at first says BP&P makes no mention, and then it goes into the Criminal Code of Canada.
Well,
which
but
is
you know,
very exciting.
Well, but you know, that's relevant too, right? Because I mean, obviously, a knife can be used, and knives are often used if one studies crime. Knives are a weapon of choice for many, many different forms of crime. And so, I mean, obviously the criminal code does have to touch on that reality, mm-hmm. which in turn means that, you know, it could be possible, you know, within the criminal code that certain restrictions are placed on kinds of knives. And in fact, there are restrictions in the criminal code mm-hmm. on, you know, certain kinds of knives. Blade length could be a thing that is restricted, but as it turns out,
not restricted. It doesn't define the length of the blade. It instead focuses on how the blade opens. So if it opens automatically by gravity, centrifugal force, or by hand pressure applied to a button or a spring, so a spring-loaded knife, would not be allowed in the Criminal Code of Canada.
Mm-hmm. Or a knife that you can just flip open.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I mean, that one is kind of a known thing. Yeah, switchblades have been verboten for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Interesting here on the wiki. Now, and so the wiki, the way they structure the myth, so they present the myth, they present, you know, the factual rebuttal, they present sources to support the factual rebuttal. In this case, you know, Criminal Code of Canada, Part 3, Firearms and Other Weapons, and, you know, the related definitions of prohibited weapons. But then it also puts a, quote, sensible, so sort of like a recommendation. Mm-hmm. And here it actually does, you know, coming back to our previous discussion, it says, it would be wise to advise scouts to carry knives of practical quality and size, preferably with a safety lock mechanism. So there's that.
Mm-hmm.
The safety lock is a preference, but not a requirement.
Yeah.
So there's knives, and that's good because, you know what? I mean, the knife that I usually carry on me, I think it's a 6-inch blade. It's my, it's a Schrade old timer. Mm. It's about my third one that I've had to purchase because, they get used a lot. I've broken two of them already.
Oh gosh. Yeah. I carry a Swedish fire knife, a Moa knife.
Mm.
And they're now done by Light My Fire, which means they have,
oh, they got a built-in flint
and steel. Oh, they have flint and it's a steel knife. So you can make sparks with it, which is Ooh. Very fun.
Yes. It's always fun to.
I picked it up in the scout shop, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just right out there?
Just right out there. And they come in lots of colors.
We're recording this at the Scouts Canada Adventure Center in Edmonton, Alberta.
Before we move on from knives, do we have time for a funny story?
Please.
Okay. So I used to work at the legislature. And the Alberta legislature, which is our government building here, has airport security as you go in. Now, the airport security is all run by retired police officers or members of the forces. And one day, there was a group of grade 6 students, so about 12 years old, going through security. And they stopped this girl because she had set off the
alarm.
Metal detector.
Yeah.
And they have her empty her pockets and she pulls out her knife. And they go, "What? Why do you have a knife?" And she's like, "Well, I'm a scout. Of course I have a knife." And that was the end of the story.
Nice. Did they let her keep it?
She got it back after she watched Question Period.
Yeah. Fair enough. It's funny, you know, you mentioned, because that is, that her mentality is exactly the same one I have. Mm-hmm. It's just like, why would I not have my knife on me? Like, I mean, and a lot of it does come down to mentality, right? Like, you know, and this is, I think, one of the reasons why the knife permit and the knife safety training are such good things, right? Because, I mean, like, it's very easy to just stereotype or to just, you know, write off a knife as just another concealed weapon or whatever, right? Or just another weapon that, you know, nobody should have. But, and I mean, certainly it can be used in that capacity, but, you know, fundamentally, it's much more than that. Like, it's a darn useful tool. I mean, I use my knife to open boxes and unscrew my computer cases and just every, you know, pry up things. That's how I broke one of them, unfortunately. But you know what? Sometimes just that the point of a blade is the only thing that fits into, you know, like a stroller wheel or something. But
very useful tool.
Very useful tool. Mm-hmm. And it just, it really, if you've gone through scouting and if you've had good knife safety training, it really does become almost an extension of you, you know? And it's like, and then if you don't have it, you're just like, well, that doesn't feel right. And you forget that you have it sometimes too, right? As I'm sure she did, as I often do. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, like I've been, my first Schrade, I had to leave at the airport in Edmonton for 3 weeks. It was just like, you know, I was showed up for a work trip and it was like a 3 week trip to Saudi Arabia or wherever. And going through customs and kind of just like, and I mean, like, the metal detector didn't find it. I found it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, still, like, and it was an early morning. It was like 3 a.m. because I had to I had to fly from there to LAX to fly to Dubai. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it was going to be a long day. And I just threw on, you know, the clothes that were there, and headed out the door in the morning. And yeah, I get to the airport. I'm like, okay, well, I got to go through security, emptying my pockets. Okay, fine. Phone. Most of the stuff's in my jacket. It's not a big deal. But like, there's a couple of things that are in my pants, like phone, wallet. Oh, no. Hi, knife. So I just kind of walk up to the counter. I'm just like, so here's all my stuff that's going through the scanner. And I'm like holding up the Schrade. And he's just like, okay, well, like, I totally forgot this was in my pants. What are my options? And he's just like, well, you can mail it to yourself or you can leave it here in like a locker. And there's a small fee for that. But so, yeah, it was like flew out, came back 3 weeks later, paid whatever it was and just picked it up at the information desk. But it's just you forget it's there until you need it. And then it's just like, hey, then it's right there. All right. Well, a couple of other myths that I wanted to, and this, okay, this next one is one that admittedly I'm flabbergasted that I still have to explain that this isn't the case to people. But there it is. The myth. Scouting is for boys. And it's crazy the places I see this crop up. Like, I mean, we'll be doing bottle drives. And like the way we do bottle drives is we deliver flyers a few days beforehand so that people know we're going to come through the area. And the flyers actually have some basic, you know, little suggestions on them. It's like, if you don't want us to knock on your door, just like tape it to the door. And we tell all our scouts, you know, oh yeah, hey, if you see the flyer taped to the door and no bottles, that means they don't want to be disturbed. Just grab the flyer and leave the house alone. Polite little thing we do. If we don't see a flyer, we'll knock on the door. And if you want to give us bottles but don't want us to knock on your door, then just put them in a bag, tape the flyer to it, and be done. Well, of course, I mean, let's face it, the flyer's on like a little strip of paper that's like, you know, I mean, we just print them on 8.5 by 11, but then they're cut down to like, so it's like 8.5 by 1, right? Mm-hmm. This is a thin little strip of paper. I can lose a thin little strip of paper in about 5 minutes if I'm not careful. So, you know, some people, they don't, I totally lost that Boy Scout thing. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to put a sign on my bottles for the Boy Scouts, mm-hmm. you know? And of course, this was really hilarious the last time I was doing a bottle drive because it was me, my two daughters, another scouter, and two other girls. Okay. So I've got two cubs, two beavers, all female. Me and the scouter are literally the only, you know, we are the male scouts, as it were. All the youth are female. And so, yeah, we walk up to this one house and there's the big bottles for the Boy Scouts. The two cubs are just kind of like, are they talking about us? Mm-hmm. but I'll still be approached by people. Like, I've been approached by people at events, mm-hmm. In the park.
Yep.
And they're inquiring about, like, you know, membership. Mm-hmm. And they'll look at the group and they're just like, oh, you have, girls can join scouts now? And I'm just like, yeah, since 1997.
Yep.
My wife tells me that she talks to, I mean, because she takes the kids to school and she, you know, so she's getting into conversations all the time with like the other parents there, mm-hmm. Most of them mothers. And even there, like, she's come back to me and, you know, conveyed their surprise because they discuss like extracurricular activities that the kids are involved in. And so scouts has come up as a conversation piece a few times. And a lot of them have put their daughters into the guiding movement, which obviously exists as an alternative for young women. Right. So then when she's like, oh yeah, ours are in beavers, cubs, and they're just like, the scouts? Yeah. Just like, oh, we didn't even know girls could join scouts. Just like, and then she comes back to me and she's just like, wait, how long have they been able to join scouts? exactly 20 years this year.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you'd think they would have marketed that better.
Well, they did change their name. So the Wikipedia is saying that in 2007, the Boy Scouts of Canada legally changed their name to Scouts Canada. And in 1972, Scouts Canada, or Boy Scouts of Canada, I guess at that time, began accepting female members into the Rover section. And then this was expanded in 1984 to the Venturer section. And then in 92, co-ed scouting was an option for all program sections and became policy in 1998.
Yep.
So your history moment. But I would say most of our membership is still male. And I think that's largely due to the fact that Girl Guides is so widely marketed as the option for girls worldwide.
Mm-hmm. I think what I've heard, and I mean, this is more anecdotal than, you know, like, so I can't exactly cite hard numbers. What I've heard is that certainly in urban centers, you'll see the more traditional split. Mm-hmm. Scouts for boys, guides for girls. In rural areas where there isn't necessarily a population base to support both, mm-hmm. You'll find more 50-50 splits, or, you know, much more like near parity scout groups, right? Mm. Because in that case, it makes more sense for a scout group to be founded. You know, like if you don't have the population base and the volunteer base to support both a guide group and a scout group, it makes more sense to put a scout group together because you can capture both boys and girls with that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, what I have heard, and this is, again, anecdotal, is that in rural areas, you'll see closer to parity. But yeah, in urban centers, obviously, where you have a much larger population base and you can find, I mean, not without struggle, but you can usually find volunteers to run both guide and scout groups, you tend to see the traditional split.
I'm trying to think of the rural areas that I support, and I can't really say what the split's like numbers-wise, but it does make sense. Like, if you have a smaller population, you don't want to draw on two volunteer organizations to do the same or the similar job, right? So you can capture more under the umbrella of scouting.
Yeah, and
or the next town will have scouts and the town after will have guides. And sometimes they're willing to drive between the two.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends, right? Like if it's the distance between like Vermilion and Manville, it's 20 clicks up the road. It's not a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Vermilion and Wainwright, that's a little bit farther. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I'm just going with, like, examples I have in my head because I'm out that end of the province all the time. But mm-hmm. And you're right, you know, just to kind of go into the history, right? Because, yeah, the Rovers, that was back in the 70s when they really started that. And then Vents. And, like, I can remember being a scout myself, and we didn't have any female scouts in our group, but the 130th did. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like, oh, well, that's neat. Mm-hmm. Actually, one of the scouts in the 130th was the daughter of one of my scouters.
Oh, okay.
And it's, which I always thought was kind of weird. Just like, okay, well, she's over there, but he's, okay, well, whatever, fine. Mm-hmm. They want to do it that way. That's cool, right? I mean, a lot of youth do appreciate, I suppose, the you know, being able to have that sort of, you know, time where they can start to just be a little bit out from under the umbrella of their parents, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So,
and I grew up as a member of guiding at this time. I just aged myself there, and I was put in Girl Guides because I was just before the cutoff where it was entirely co-ed. But my mom had been in guiding, so I got put in guiding, and that was the option. And so are my cousins, and my family is a guiding family, and I guess I'm the black sheep because I work for scouting. it's more fun that way. But I really like that a lot of girls will also choose to do both, depending mm-hmm. on the activities that they want to do. Guiding does a lot of the same things scouting does, but I think there's a lot more opportunities for leadership inherent in the program in scouting. For example, like an area youth commissioner. That's not a role that we have in guiding. It's such a great leadership opportunity.
Definitely. Or even just at a more practical level. Like, I mean, one of my new cubs this year made the switch. Like, she actually flipped from guiding, which she had been enrolled in previously, over to, she's enrolled as a cub this year. And the reason for that, and I mean, I'm going to preface this by saying that, well, it's funny because I'm going to repeat this anecdote about two different people because it's the same thing I've heard from two different people. And I should really preface it by saying that this is something that is not unique to guiding. This is something that is also, this can be a big issue for scouting groups as well. And it seems to me to be one of the biggest reasons why I've seen people go out of their way to make big transitions between groups, between, or even between, like, you know, movements. So we have a new cub coming on, and the message from her family was that basically her older brother, a scout, and her younger brother, a beaver, have been talking about all the stuff they've been doing. Mm-hmm. And she wants to get in on that, especially the outdoor stuff, the camp stuff, because, you know, her experience of how her guiding group, I don't know which one it is, has been run is that it's mostly like crafts and stuff. And there's nothing wrong with crafts, but if it's not to the temperament of the youth, obviously it's not going to capture them, right? Mm-hmm. And similarly, like I remember posting about on Facebook, like enrolling my daughters in beavers and just, you know, some of the stuff that we were doing throughout the year. And my cousin, who had been in guides herself, you know, messaged me and she's just like, wait, when have girls been able to join scouts? And I was, since 97 officially, and earlier than that, if you really want to get into the, you know, because they rolled out the policy quite gradually. And she came back and she said, oh, I wish my mom would have known that. I'm so bored in guides. I just wanted to be out camping. And so again, but again, like those two criticisms, which is really the same criticism in both cases, right? It's not about guiding in particular. It's about how those particular groups ran their programming, right?
100%.
And we've seen that. I mean, we've seen that on the scouting side too, right? Mm-hmm. Like I've picked up numerous youth and some very excellent scouters because they've become dissatisfied with the groups that they're in and, you know, basically found our group because they were looking for a change. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, that's an episode for there. That's a whole nother episode of discussion right there. It's just, you know, like we can talk about how to retain people, but you know, we can almost, you know, flip, and we've talked about retention on some previous episodes before, but we can almost flip that around and be just like, now here's how you lose people.
that would be a fun episode.
Here are some great ways to drive people out of your group. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's the only other one other anecdote I have, and this is from my mother, who was, she led Brownies and Sparks. I don't think she ever got up to guides. I don't think my sister's ever stuck around that long. Mm. But one of the issues that her group had was that they had, two families where, actually in both cases, the fathers were widowers. Mm-hmm. And really were just like, they were so desperate to be involved with this activity that their daughters were engaging in. And there were a lot of obstacles in the way of that. So, I mean, they made what accommodations they could. And obviously, you know, the regulations, the bylaws and policies and procedures of guides does allow for, some involvement by, you know, fathers and male volunteers. But I think in both cases, you know, like those youth just wound up drifting away because, you know, what they could do with their dad and what they couldn't do with their dad was just, it was too limited.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really great point about scouting is that scouting is something you can do with your entire family. Scouting doesn't ask, they don't care, what you identify as. They just want you to come out and have fun doing, adventure activities. And mm-hmm. That's why scouting has such a large umbrella, right? Like, they're welcome to everyone.
Yeah, and it's nice to see. Mm-hmm. All right. There was one more myth I wanted to jump into. And then, well, two more technically, but one in particular. I mean, the friendship knot is just something. I wanted to talk about the friendship knot just briefly because, you know, I like the friendship knot.
I love the friendship knot.
I learned to tie it at one jamboree or another, and it's just been my go-to. But apparently, someone was propagating the myth at some point in time that the friendship knot is not approved for wear on Scouts Canada properties, or as part of the uniform.
I love how deep this myth goes. Not on properties. Nowhere you wear the friendship knot.
May not wear a friendship knot if you were doing a scouting thing anywhere. It's like, well, no, there's no restriction on the use of the friendship knot in place of the wakul. It's a great casual alternative. And I mean, this is something I appreciate at a very practical level. Mm-hmm. You know, because I deal with beavers and I deal with cubs. I probably have given 2 to 3 woggles to each beaver I've ever had in my sections.
I can see how they would be easily lost.
Sometimes in the same meeting. And it's just, I mean, because they're small kids, you know?
They're
small kids. The label busy beaver is well-deserved. Mm-hmm. And they just, stuff gets lost. Stuff gets left behind. And it's one thing if it's a hat. You know, I can pick up a hat at the end of a meeting and be just like, whose is this?
Yeah.
But a woggle's tiny. It's small. It's just this tiny little blue thing.
It'll roll under something. Mm-hmm.
They take off their scarf for, you know, 5 minutes because they're doing a big running activity and they're feeling a little warm. And the woggle gets set down separate from the scarf and it gets kicked into a corner and
it's gone.
Yeah, you don't notice it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, by the time, you know, 2 weeks later, the janitor's long taken care of it and just like, oh, well, whatever, that's not going to happen. Like, I mean, I like how studious my daughter is whenever she takes her necker off. She, you know, she makes sure she kind of pulls it out tight and clips her woggle around it to make sure that, you know, she's not going to lose it. But that's just her. She's very particular that way. And not every beaver is going to do that.
Yeah.
And so
I'd say most beavers won't do that.
No,
most won't. Because tag is too much fun.
It is. To even, you know, to pause for those extra 20 seconds. But yeah, it's, so I mean, you know what? Yeah. At the end of a meeting, I've got, you know, kids who are just like, oh, what do I do? Well, I have no idea where your woggle is. We've looked around the room. We can't find it. It's gone. Sometimes they're just like, I lost it at home. I have no idea what to do. I'm just like, well, come here. Friendship knot. Done.
Done. Yep. And I like the friendship knot because of what it symbolizes. I first received a friendship knot from my roommate in London, Tomomi. I worked at the guide center there for 4 months.
Ooh.
And so she tied the friendship knot on my necker and technically with a friendship knot is you're not supposed to untie it, but sometimes you just got to. If you want to wash your necker properly, please untie your friendship knot.
Yes.
But then whenever I tie it back in, I'm like, oh, Tomomi gave this to me. I should Facebook her. I should talk to her again. And it's really great way to remember all of the friendships that you have in scouting. So I love the friendship knot for that reason. And I wear it all the time. I slip my woggle further up my necker, tie the friendship knot in, and I just run around wherever.
Yeah, that's, you know? I had the same experience. Like, I mean, it wasn't the first time I had a friendship knot tied, but there was a Swiss rover that I was working with at the event that I was running at WJ 2007. And, you know, she just grabbed her necker one day, tied a friendship knot in, and handed it to me. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like you say, you know, yeah, to wash a necker, you do kind of have to untie it. And it was a white necker. So, I mean, it shows any kind of stains really, really easily. Mm-hmm. But it's like the first time I had to untie it, it's just kind of like, ooh, I'm very hesitant about this. Why am I so hesitant about this? Right? Yeah. Like it is, there's a beautiful symbolism to it. And it does have some real lasting, there's sort of a lasting impact to it. It's really cool. So, anyways, last thing I wanted to talk about, uniforms and insurance. Oh my gosh. And I mean, this is one that was drilled into me when I was a scout, right?
I even heard this as a guide going around like, oh, why do all the scouts have their neckers on? Oh, it's because they don't have insurance otherwise.
It's like, I remember,
I've heard that.
I remember flying back from London, WJ 2007. I'm a 26-year-old dude. And there I am in full kit on the plane. Now, actually, that worked out really, really well because there were like some younger youth that had also been flying back. And so they were all like walking up to me mid-flight and asking if I had like badges to trade and things like that. It was really, really cool.
Yeah.
But still, yeah, it's like that was a pervasive thing even to the point where I was aging out of Rovers. Mm-hmm. And but apparently, there is no such restriction.
Yep. Now, I would say that if you're going out of your hall, a really great free publicity for your group and for scouting, if you want to show the world that scouting is co-ed and welcomes everyone, wear your uniform in public so that the public knows that scouting is still around, because that's the other one I'll get all the time. What, scouting still exists? but that's a topic for another time.
Yes.
But definitely, as long as you're doing an activity that falls within BPMP and you've done your due diligence as a scouter in doing a proper risk assessment and all the safety forms, then you're covered by insurance. And like, sometimes it's not going to be appropriate for you to wear your scouting uniform. Like if you're scuba diving, please don't have your necker on.
Yeah, I could see how that would be a little bit. Now, I mean, now that said, as much as possible, but even then, like, this isn't for insurance purposes. This is, as you said, you know, it's just kind of like, well, show your scout and pride, right? Mm-hmm. It's very much a case of like, if I, as much as possible, I do try and encourage the youth to be in scouting gear. Like the usual ones I'll say is, I mean, if you can be in your uniform, great, be in your uniform. The activity shirts, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of the official Scouts Canada activity gear are a great second option. And if you have a shirt from like a camp that you've been to, that's a great mm-hmm. third option, right? Those are the usual three things that I'll try and encourage youth to wear at any given outing. But even if none of that's an option for them for whatever reason, the necker at least, right? Like, mm-hmm. okay, well, at least we're all, you know, showing our colors. But, you know, just, yeah, have a little bit of pride in the uniform. Just, you know, be really actually quite proud to wear it out as part of activities. It's something I try and encourage. It's not something I enforce, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as much as possible, just trying, yeah, like, we should be doing this. Yeah. I mean, I'll wear my uniform to just about anything. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not necessary for insurance. It's really just, it's a good thing to do because, you know, hey, like, I mean, you are part of the organization. And if you're happy about that, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. Well, if you're happy to be a scout and you know it, wear your necker.
Yeah, definitely. But not necessary for insurance.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there one other thing I wanted to add about that? No, there wasn't. That's all right. Cool. Yeah, those are the big ones, I think, that I wanted to cover. Actually, there was one more. You know what? While we got a moment, I want to do one more. Just okay. Because this is something that actually has been baffling me.
Okay.
Okay. So, and it's not really so, I mean, there's a myth on the wiki, you know, the myth, a scouter cannot drive a youth other than their own child to or from scouting activities. This is not in fact true. Well, it's partly true because Scouts Canada policies don't cover transportation to scouting activities. It's up to parents to arrange transportation. Travel to and from a scouting activity is not part of the scouting activity itself, and therefore scouting policies don't apply. Now, I guess just where I've always been a little bit baffled by this is, or not baffled, that might not be the right word, but like where I've had some struggle with this is, I mean, the wiki lays it out fairly plainly, but how it lays it out adds some additional questions to my mind.
It does.
Stuff like, if, you know, I mean, if I'm meeting with my youth and then we're all driving down to Camp Woods for Beaverie, right? Technically, the drive down is not considered a scouting activity. So, too deep doesn't apply, or does it?
It's interesting. So,
and sorry, just yeah. to kind of finish framing that mm-hmm. question, you know, if we're in a case where, you know, like we're not on a scouting activity and too deep doesn't apply, or does it? How does, you know, how is it still an insurable thing under the scouting umbrella?
So scouting doesn't cover any car insurance mm-hmm. for volunteers, period.
Right.
In any way. So mm-hmm. so that would be at your own risk and on your own insurance. If you got into a collision, that is on you as the driver mm-hmm. and your car insurance. So you might want to, if you are driving youth, even for the soccer carpool, you might want to call your insurance company and say, hey, if I'm carpooling, is this covered under my insurance, just as like a life note? But for scouting, the activity starts at the activity. And it doesn't include driving. However, if you want to make it easy on yourself, you could rent a bus, like charter a bus, like a yellow school bus, that is. They're cheaper than coach buses. And then transportation's included. Everybody arrives together. And you have the two-scouter rule, because you're going to have two scouters. At least you're going to have ratio on the bus. So that would be my suggestion. But it says you do so at your own risk. So this is their sensible option, which I kind of like. Travel to and from a scouting activity is not part of the scouting activity itself. Therefore, scouting policies don't apply. Should a parent agree to have somebody transport their child and they happen to also be a scouter, that can be done, but only at the scouter and the parent's own risk. So the parent is making this decision.
Okay.
And you're doing it as a parent and as a family friend. But then it adds in, be careful, scouters. We're busy enough. Don't get into the habit of being a free taxi driver.
Right. And I mean, like, is not like, you know, if... Like, I mean, and it's not that I have a problem taking other youth with me. You know, I'm driving down to the event anyways, and I'm obviously taking, you know, either my beaver or my cub, depending on what event we're going to. Sure. I got a couple of extra seats in the car. Let's do this. I don't have a problem with that personally. But equally, I have had some people express concerns about that in the past, you know, just because it isn't covered under scout insurance. And I mean... I think I read somewhere, and I didn't see it in the transportation policy page right now, but I think I read somewhere there was a recommendation of having, like, you know, liability insurance of around $1 million. But I could be wrong, but I seem to recall seeing that number somewhere.
That number might be higher.
Potentially.
A lot of people will carry $2 million.
Yeah, that's true too. Right? But anyway, so yeah, I mean, obviously make sure your own insurance is good. And I mean, you know, obviously be honest with yourself in your assessment of your ability to safely drive from point A to point B.
And it might be like if you're backpacking with youth and you get off the trail at 6 p.m. and you've been hiking all day, are you going to be physically able to drive from Edmonton or sorry, from Banff or Jasper to Edmonton? Like if you're super tired, can you safely drive somebody else's children? I like to call other people's children somebody else's baby. Because their mothers are instantly going to go, that's my baby.
Yes, yeah. It does kind of, you know, serve to illustrate the point. Yeah, so like I say, that one's not so much like a myth that was, you know, dispelling, but it was always just like a point of confusion for me. It's just because it's very much, in a way, it's kind of just a technicality, and it introduces like, introduced a little measure of confusion, right? Because yeah, technically, we're not doing a scouting activity while we're on the way down to camp. So if you do have a scouter driving three youth in a car, you're not technically violating ratio. You're not technically violating too deep. But equally, it is kind of a technicality.
Yeah.
And then of course, once you get on site, all of that goes away. And you know, there you are at a scouting event and all of those requirements come back into force.
Yeah. And you also want to make sure that the parents know if you're driving their children that the driving part is not part of scouting, because the parents might be assuming that, because if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, they're going to assume it's a duck, right?
Right.
So if you're wearing your scout shirt and you're Scouter Joe, the parents are going to assume that Scouts Canada is footing this bill, right? Personally, in my Girl Guide unit, I don't drive girls because I do not want the liability on my head of ruining my insurance for the rest of my life for wrecking a car with 4 teenagers in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's my personal choice. I know a lot of other people do choose to drive other people's children. Not something I do, though. But then I don't have kids, so maybe I'm just not at that point in my life yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I already explained my reasoning. So, anyways. Well, thank you. That was a good and, I hope, enlightening discussion, you know, covering off. And I mean, oh my gosh, we could probably do many more episodes on scouting myths and probably more than even just what the wiki covers. But those are some good ones to start just because they're things that, you know, I've certainly had to deal with recently myself. So thank you for that and for your time. I guess I should ask, as per our custom, do you have any shout outs?
do I have any shout outs?
Mm-hmm.
Like to who?
Well, I don't know. Like, I mean, I always say a big thanks to the folks at Scouting Radio for rebroadcasting our episodes to their worldwide audience. And if you're listening to us on Scouting Radio right now, please do reach out, get in touch, and we'll talk about how to do that in a couple of minutes here. But, you know, if there is any individuals in, you know, just recent weeks that have done some really admirable scouting things that you want to publicly acknowledge, by all means, feel free.
Hmm. I'd say shout out to everybody who helped put in the piers and the docks at Camp Woods and Camp Pool this weekend. A lot of youth are going to get amazing opportunities to swim and canoe and play on the inflatables because of the work you did. So thank you so much for helping out at Pool and Woods.
Oh, cool. Actually, I'll get to see those in a couple of weeks then at Beaverie.
Yeah. Hopefully the lakes will be warm enough. In Alberta, we have what other people call cold lakes, but as an Alberta girl, yeah. I don't find them cold.
Sylvan's
usually.
Well,
I wear usually, a wetsuit. Yeah. But
Sylvan's usually all right by June. It's not like we're going to Beaver Mines Lake, which is like directly glacially fed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, should be all right. Some of my kids will probably still dive in anyways. Whatever. All right. Well, thank you. If you want to get in touch with us, you can, of course, email us, scoutingstuffpodcast@gmail.com. You can leave us a voice message. Just go to scoutingstuffpodcast.com, and there'll be a little link to do that. You can follow us on Twitter at @SSYSKpodcast. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/scoutingstuffpodcast. My gosh, it's getting hard to remember all of this stuff. Or if you want, you can leave us a review on iTunes. We like those too, and that helps make the podcast a little more visible. Well, thank you, Regan, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you out there for listening. And until next time, be prepared.